Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call to order the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, noting that a quorum is present. Today is the 14th of March, and we are going to be continuing with a public hearing, which I'll open right now, on House Bill 5016, the budget for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Ms. Deister, anything new since we last met?
Since we last met, no, nothing new, Mr. Co-Chair. Today we'll be hearing from the Civil Rights Division, the Technical Assistance for Employers Program, and from DAS. If you're trying to access the meeting materials, go to yesterday's meeting and you'll have the presentation that you can pull up on your devices. So,
and if anyone in the crowd that's here in the room wants to take part in public testimony, please sign up, and we'll be happy to hear from you a little later in the meeting. So, Commissioner Avakian, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We ended yesterday's meeting with the question from Senator Hansel relative to the new paid sick days law and how that relates to family farms in Oregon. And so we'll pick up there. I want to preface my comments with at least part of the thread that you were, I think, talking about yesterday, that we agree with, that the culture and the history of family farms is very important to both the economy and to the structure of rural Oregon. And for many reasons, we know that it's harder and harder for those family farms to make it anymore. And we want to be supportive. So let's take a look at the statute that was passed and how that statute is being interpreted. Keeping in mind what I said yesterday, that in interpreting statutes, either through the passage of administrative rules or in issuing formal decisions, legislative intent is only considered when a statute is ambiguous. We don't believe that the paid sick days statute is ambiguous, and with respect to the section that we were talking about yesterday, which really hinges on the definition of an employee and the definition of an employer. The definition of employee is used in this statute doesn't include an individual that is employed by his or her parent, spouse, or child. That's the current statutory language. Now, when a business is a corporation, and oftentimes family farms are corporations, the employer is the corporation. It's not the parent. So if you have a situation where there's a couple that runs their own family farm, they've got their children that are working on the farm, and they decide to incorporate in order to get the protections that the corporate shield provides when you incorporate, the question is, are the children then an employee of the corporation, or are they employee of the parents as individuals? Under this statute and other statutes that have been interpreted for years, it is the corporation that is the employer and not the individual. Now, here is what we believe is the biggest problem presented if we try and interpret that differently, is that many of the reasons that a person will incorporate their business is in order to get the corporate shield that protects them from individual liability. And if we interpret individual parents or other family members as the employer when they have a corporation, that likely destroys the corporate shield that they have.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Likely destroys the corporate shield based on whose interpretation? Yours or DOJ, or who espouses that theory?
Well, we do.
You do based on your lawyering inside the agency, or who? On what authority do you base that piercing of the corporate shield theory?
Well, first, this is just, Madam Chair, this is one piece to the analysis that would concern us if we use a different interpretation. But we believe that when a person incorporates, if they then act as an individual in the operation of the business, and certainly if we deem the employer to be the individual and not the business, we think that poses a problem for the corporate.
And
Jill,
I'm asking you, is it other than just your opinion, or have you sought legal advice from your counsel?
No, we don't. I don't believe that we need legal advice from our council to come to that determination. We are the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We're the agency that is in charge of interpreting these statutes, and that's the way that we would interpret it.
Okay. Well, that's great.
Senator Hanson?
Well, maybe you can help me. When these bills were discussed on the floor of the Senate, mm-hmm. by the sponsors in both the Senate and in the House, and I quote from Representative Hovey, when asked on the floor to explain who is covered and who is not, and he says, if a family member is working for another family member, are they covered by the bill? And that they are not. It's explicit in the bill. There is no confusion about that. And when we have the intent of the legislation and the legislators passing this bill, it seems frequently, and this is, I've got several examples here, that it is discussed both sides of the aisle. Everybody understands what they're voting on. And then when the bill is passed and signed into law, then your department comes in with a different interpretation. And the legislative intent, from my point of view, is really clear. So you interpret it differently, and you embark on another road that, had that been known ahead of time, the bill might not have become law. And that's where I need some help. Okay. Another example would be the administrative rules on minimum wage. Senator Dembler was very clear on his testimony that if your operation was in one of the zones and it carried you, say, Les Schwab changing a tire elsewhere, and another zone that you go back, you interpret it differently other than what was said by the carriers of the bills on the floor in answer to questions. Mm-hmm. And it's concerning to me. How do we get over that? I mean, what's...
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, we actually agree with Representative Holby's comment on the floor. Representative Holby said, if a family member is working for another family member, are they covered under this bill? Rhetorical question. They are not. And we agree that if an individual is working for another family member, they would not be covered under the bill. But if they are working for a corporation, then they are covered under the bill. And so if there, and I would want to highlight that we have to first look to the actual plain language of the statute. I don't believe that the committee is proposing that we should rely on the floor speeches as opposed to the plain language of the statute. We want this statute to work for everybody, and if it's the legislature's intent that family farms be excluded from the bill, then we would want to provide whatever assistance to you we could in making sure that the wording of the statute itself says that. But it doesn't. It still relies on the other statutory language between individuals and corporations. So if a family farm were to be a sole proprietorship, there would be no problem. But if a family farm is a corporation, then we get hung up because of the language in the bill.
Follow up, Senator.
So if a family family farm corporation, such as the ones that we have on our farm, are solely owned totally by a family, it doesn't qualify. And family members work for the family owned and are part of the structure. You're saying that on that, the corporation, even though it's only owned by the family, doesn't count.
Madam Chair, Senator, if the family farm is incorporated under the laws of Oregon and they're a registered corporation and they have employees, the employees are employees of the corporation, not of the individuals.
So, Senate Bill, if I may, on a follow-up,
please.
Senate Bill 779 attempts to fix that. Would you be in support of that to clarify this up for your department?
Well, before I just shoot from the hip here. I'd rather take another look at the bill, make sure it accomplishes what you want it to accomplish, Senator. We'd be happy to provide whatever technical assistance this body needs in order to resolve this issue.
And Commissioner, to your point about corporations, would that apply whether it's an S corp or a C corp?
Yes, as long as it's incorporated. The difference is one between a sole proprietorship and a corporation rather than the various definitions of a corporation.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I guess I'm not satisfied with the technical assistance answer. I'm perfectly happy to have you review the bill rather than to be put on the spot, but I would respectfully ask for a written response provided to the professional staff and distributed to the committee. You just have said we'd like to help you clarify this, and I think some of us are asking for clarification in Senate Bill 779 and want to know if we're going to be fighting the agency.
Well, Madam Chair, we're not interested in any kind of a fight with you or this body on the bill. We simply want to be able to implement what it is you pass, and if the policy that you want is to exclude family farms, we would be more than pleased to comment on whether or not we think the bill does that. And if you'd like that in writing, we'd be more than pleased to do that.
Any further questions on this topic? Commissioner, did you have anything else to add?
No, I have nothing else. If you don't have any other questions on this topic, let me introduce Amy Clare, the administrator of the Civil Rights Division, and we'll pick up there.
And welcome, Ms. Clara.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm pleased to appear before you today to give an overview of the Civil Rights Division. I want to apologize in advance that I hope I do not go into a coughing jag during my presentation, but I seem to have caught the bug that has been floating around in Portland and Salem and everywhere else. So I'll do my best here. So the Civil Rights Division is charged with enforcing anti-discrimination laws in the areas of employment, housing, places of public accommodation, and career schools. Most of our complaints involve in two different kind of categories of types of cases, those are involving protected classes such as your race, your gender, your age, whether or not you have a disability, your religion, et cetera. Those are called protected classes. We also have laws we enforce that that protect individuals that engage in protected activities such as filing a workers' comp claim, using family leave, filing a thank you, raising a work safe place safety violation. Those are called protected activities. Then I'll move on. So our funding sources, we have varied funding sources. The majority of our funds are general fund at 58%, and then the next largest slice of our pie is with our EEOC contract, and then the next is the injured worker contract that we have. We enforce three different statutes involving protections for injured workers, and then we also have a contract with Oregon OSHA to enforce protections for workers who report workplace safety violations, and that's about 9% of our budget. That remaining 2% is sort of miscellaneous receipts. We have routine copy requests made for civil rights cases from both parties that are usually if they're preparing to go to litigation, and the costs that we charge to make those public records actually funds, just about funds one office specialist in our division.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I guess a curiosity for me is if multiple parties to the case ask for the record, mm-hmm. do you charge each one of them?
Yes, we do.
Why can't you put it electronically and not charge them other than your desire for the revenue?
Madam Chair, we Depending on who's requesting the copy request, the items they may want in the file might be different. So, and some of we have to redact the record depending on who's requesting. So, a complainant that's filed a complaint may not be able to get the same items that the respondent provided to the agency because it may not be subject to public records disclosure. So, depending on who's asking for the complaint, the redaction will vary. But we do make PDFs of the complaints, and we do provide those electronic, I mean, of the case files electronically at the party's request.
And you charge for that?
Yes, we do.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up. One of the things that you may have covered yesterday, and I apologize because I was MIA for a little while, but I want to revisit in phase two what things you do charge for, publications that could, in some people's opinion, I understand and accept your answer on this particular mm-hmm. case, but some materials that are identical, that are for sale versus being available electronically, especially for the benefit of employers. Mm-hmm. And I think given the totality of technology right now and the fact that you are the Bureau of Labor and Industry, I'm curious about what publications are sold to employers versus what could be available online as a courtesy to the business community. And so you could either respond to that now or come back with it in phase two.
Okay. Co-Chair Johnson, I believe that the speaker after me with the technical assistance unit that provides services to employers probably can answer that question better. The Civil Rights Division only charges for copy requests that are pertaining to case files that are closed. That makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, she's nodding, so that makes perfect sense.
Okay. Okay, so these are just some quick facts about the division's work. So we receive actually 40,000 plus inquiries a year. Those are people that are calling us, sending emails, or walking in the door asking about their rights. And that translates down to about 1,700 complaints. So we spend a lot of time answering questions about things that may not be what we have jurisdiction over, but we can help people find the right services. Or we answer their questions and they decide not to follow through with filing a complaint. So there's a lot of work done at the entry level to kind of screen cases down, and I'll get more into that later. But that number of inquiries translates down to anywhere between 1,700 on average up to 2,000 complaints a year.
If I file a claim, I communicate with your office
yes.
I think I have a claim. What's the timeline profile of a typical response? When do I expect to hear from you?
Okay.
How's that all work?
And I'll get more into that in the key performance measure summary. But so we, if you were to contact us by phone, it'll be an office specialist that'll answer the phone, and they're going to screen just to see if you say you want to file a complaint. They want to find out some basic jurisdictional things to see if we have jurisdiction over the issue that you're discussing. A lot of times people call, and they're complaining about something that is maybe discriminatory, but it's not unlawful. It's not something that we enforce. So we do that type of screening. If you make it through that, they will send you out a complaint questionnaire. Once the complainant fills out that questionnaire, we also have them available online, and they can be filled out online. When it comes back to our agency, that is a complaint questionnaire. We have a performance measure to complete those, to draft a charge from that questionnaire within 15 days. And after that charge is drafted, then it's signed by the complainant, which would be if you were the complainant, and then it's assigned to an investigator. So we try to get that all done within the first 3 weeks.
Would it follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Would it be possible for you to provide to the professional staff copies of all your intake paperwork?
Absolutely.
So that the committee can see what are the typical questions that would either be filled out online or asked by an office specialist?
Co-Chair, it's Johnson and Gomberg. I'd be happy to provide that for you.
I would respectfully ask that we do it across the agency, not just in the Civil Rights Division.
Certainly.
Thank you.
So 90% of our cases involve employment. That's the vast majority of the work that we see in the division. The remaining 10% pertains to housing, career schools, places of public accommodation. The top areas where we see discrimination complaints are in disability, which comprise about 34% of our complaints, And then sex discrimination, that also includes sex maternity, different treatment based on sex, sexual orientation, and sex harassment. Those combined comprise about 36% of our caseload. About 17% of our caseload involves those injured worker complaints that involve those three statutes that we enforce. And then 16% involve race or color, mainly race/color discrimination complaints. And I'd like to add that most of the time when folks file with us, they file on more than one basis. So they're going to file on perhaps injured worker and disability and perhaps OFLA all in one case.
It's clear before we leave,
sure.
I believe it was last session that this body passed legislation creating a support for you to add specialists in your department dealing with people that do public entertainment, and whether they would be independent contractors or employees. Could you just give us a quick update on that program and what's going on there?
Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg, I believe that is the hotline position that was created, and that's a wage an hour, actually, position.
Excuse me. Okay. Well, then we'll come back to that later.
Yeah, we'll get you that data. I don't. It's not in my repertoire. I apologize.
And I'm sorry. I thought it would have been on your list.
Yeah, no. You never know. Okay. So this is a graph that shows the inquiries that we receive, and you'll see that it kind of vary, but they've been increasing quite a bit. I think that's largely due to fluctuations in the economy. And then there's been a lot of different pieces of legislation over successive biennia that have been passed that have put jurisdiction into the Civil Rights Division. So we spend a lot of time answering questions about those new laws as well.
Question?
Please.
Sorry, you have over 45,000 inquiries?
Yes.
Wow. And you responded?
So I can kind of describe how that happens. Through the co-chairs, Senator Hansel, we receive calls every day. And actually, more recently, we used to, frequently they would go to, because they were only being answered by intake officers, they would go to voicemail, then we'd have to return the call. We've changed that. We've trained our office specialists to answer the calls as they ring. So all of their phones ring, and so most of the calls now are answered contemporaneously. Each of those calls, each of the callers is given what's called a file number that goes into a database, and that's how we're able to track these calls. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Yeah, I would just, I'm doing it.
Senator's doing math. We'll give him one.
No, it's a lot.
125 calls per day.
Pardon me?
That's 125 calls per day, and you don't work 7 days a week. So that's pretty amazing volume.
Senator Johnson.
Are those written records considered public information?
Absolutely. So this is just a graph of the complaints that have been filed. It varies. Again, it's been around the last couple biennia, around anywhere between 1,700 and 2,000 complaints each year. This graph just shows the blue line shows all cases filed, and the components of those cases filed are those, like EEOC is the red bar. Housing cases are the green bar, injured worker, the purple bar, and OSHA cases, the blue bar. So staff asked us to come up with the average cost of a civil rights investigation, and we previously actually hadn't been asked to do that. So we did that recently, and we tracked it to the average cost of a civil rights investigation. This is one that's kind of bare bones. It has not gone through the administrative prosecution unit. This is just a basic investigation. It's around $2,700, and that's from tracking it from the intake level to the investigation level to closure and management review. The EEOC, this gives you an idea of our reimbursement. The EEOC reimburses us $700 per case, so it obviously doesn't cover the cost of the investigation. But I would like to point out that we would be investigating those cases anyway, so I guess any kind of revenue to offset the impact on the general fund still helps. Our injured worker cases, when divided up, we get paid from the Injured Worker Benefit Fund, and it's about $764,000 a biennium, and we get anywhere between 280 and 300 injured worker complaints. When you divide that up over the biennia, it adds up to around our reimbursement around $1,300 per case. And then OSHA reimburses us at $2,000 per case. Prior to April 2016, OSHA was only paying us $1,000 per case, and that had been in place for over two decades.
So if I'm reading all your slides right, Ms. Clare, it looks to me like the number of inquiries is dramatically increasing over time, but the number of investigations is staying relatively constant.
Right.
What do we attribute that distinction to?
This is a perfect segue to my next slide. So the Civil Rights Division uses a triaging system that it's very aggressive at the intake level. So when we get a complaint, a questionnaire back, the intake officers look at it and they want to discern whether or not we believe that the evidence on just the questionnaire itself would lend itself to have us believe that we would find a violation. Those are very rare, but when we find them, we want to target those for expedited investigation and adjudication. So we call those A cases. Generally, people are presenting with strong facts, objective information besides just opinion, and witness information at that level. B cases are the vast majority of the cases we investigate where we need more information to determine if substantial evidence of an unlawful discrimination or discriminatory act exists. And then C cases are those that pretty much on the face of it, we believe they're not going to have merit. We do get a fair number of those. People can insist on filing with us, and we have to, we have an attorney general opinion that we have to allow folks to file with us, but we do have discretion on how far to go with the complaint. An example of a C case that we would see on some people, you'd be surprised how much they will bust themselves on their own questionnaire. They'll say, I think I was terminated because I'm an injured worker. And then it'll say, well, why did your employer say you were terminated? They say, well, I failed a drug test and I crashed the forklift. They will often say that. So that's obviously going to be a C case. And then, so this is, we've kind of been talking about this throughout my presentation, similar to the Wage and Hour Division. The Civil Rights Division has a key performance measure that has four components. So the targets for intake include obviously returning calls within 48 hours, although most calls now are caught contemporaneously because we have all office specialists answering calls. Yeah. And then drafting of that complaint, the charge from the questionnaire. And then in the investigative portion, completing an initial interview within the first 45 days of having that case. And then under investigations, we have a performance measure to a component of that measure to complete the majority of our cases in 180 days or fewer, when by statute we have up to a year. We try to get our investigations expedited as much as possible. It's best for all parties.
Senator Hansel, you had a question?
Just had a quick question on the A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. If you took the 45,000 phone calls that came in, what would be the breakdown percentage-wise, roughly, if under each one of those categories that, 20% were A? I don't know. Just is there any way to know that? Just out of curiosity.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, at the inquiry phase when we're just taking a call, most of the time we cannot tell if it's going to be something egregious, although we have had calls where if someone's describing something, we go, wow, we better immediately get them on the phone and draft a charge. For the most part, I would say when we're getting these calls, I mean, a lot of them would be C cases at that intake level on the phone call, because a lot of folks call about they're upset, they're having interpersonal problems with their, or communication problems, personality conflicts. Those are not protected classes, and so folks sometimes think I'm being discriminated against. Discrimination itself is not unlawful unless it's based on a protected class or protected activity. So I would say at the call level, we're doing a lot of education at that level. Just going through that.
And then,
I'm going to go back to my question. You've described the triage process, but again, I want to ask, the number of people inquiring to you is increasing, but the number of investigations is staying fairly static. And does that mean that the division is more visible than it may have been in the past? Are Oregonians more sensitive? Do we have more Oregonians that fit into protected classes and there might have more potential to be calling you? Why are more people reaching out to you now historically?
Co-Chair Gomberg, there have been, and I have in the budget presentation that's more thorough in my division, I actually go through all the different bills that have been passed over successive biennia. There's dozens. So there are additional protected classes. And as the media picks up on particular protected classes, then we commensurately receive more intake inquiries.
All right.
Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Yeah. And then finally, this... I'm going back to 2013 because it really has helped us over the next few biennia. We were able to get funding to reclassify two of our intake officer positions, which were at a range 19 to a range 21. And then a third intake officer position was established in the 2013 through 15 biennium, and that has enabled the division to actually be much more efficient and quickly process complaints. When I began at the agency, it was 14 years ago, there was a backlog of over 300 complaint questionnaires sitting in drawers. Now, I took a photo for the commissioner when I met with him recently. Sometimes our drawers are empty now because we're processing those so much faster with having that elevated staff level. And those intake officers are considered field rep one positions, so they can do limited investigations as well, so they can help out with the senior investigators with their caseloads. So we no longer have, for the first time, a backlog in our intake unit. That concludes my presentation. If you have any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any further questions? Yes, Representative Braden.
Thank you. And I would love to see you when you're really feeling well, because you've been doing a fantastic job today.
Don't make me laugh.
Do you have the ability to identify whether there have been maybe an increase or decrease in complaints of immigrants?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Reardon, I'd have to go back and run the numbers through to see if we can pull out, because that would be a race or national origin case. We can run those numbers. I can tell you anecdotally that the intake and support staff manager has told me that the intake officers have been reporting we'd be getting a lot more inquiries about country of origin, about people's rights to file claims with us. As you may be aware, I don't know if I'm answering your question correctly, but we do not ask about citizen status or whether or not someone's documented. If they want to file a complaint with us, they have the right to file.
And I understand that. So, Chair Gomberg, I would love to have additional follow-up information.
All right, very good.
Absolutely.
Let's get that. Any further questions? Ms. Claire, I hope you get well
Thank
soon.
You.
I sympathize. I'm just getting over Representative Reardon's cold. So.
Okay. So it's my pleasure to introduce Jennifer Germanson, and she's the manager of the Technical Assistance Unit.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Co-Chair Gomberg, committee members, my name is Jennifer Germanson. I manage the Technical Assistance for Employers program with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I am pleased to be here to tell you about the work of this program and answer any of your questions. So, Technical Assistance for Employers exists solely to educate and advise Oregon employers on employment laws. We do this in a number of ways, and I think our most well-known way of doing this is we operate an employer hotline and email service where employers can call. They now get 99% of the time they're going to get a live body on the phone. About 3 years ago, we changed our phone service. Before, people had to call and leave a message. Now they can call, and in most cases, they're going to get a live body on the phone who can answer that question immediately. We also have an email service where employers can call and ask those questions, and we can either email them or give them a call. We are a safe harbor for Oregon employers, and we let employers know this on the phone, and we conduct seminars. If you call us and you tell us you're not giving your employees breaks, you don't pay them overtime because they don't deserve it, we're going to have a conversation and we're going to explain what the law says. But what we don't do is run to our friends in wage and hour or civil rights and tell on you. So we truly are a safe harbor for employers. We also conduct public and on-site customized seminars throughout the state on a large variety of employment law topics. And a few slides from now, we'll talk about some of the different topics that we offer. We do research, write, and publish and sell 8 employer handbooks. And if you don't mind, I'll wait till the next slide when we talk about our staffing level and our funding. We update the composite employment law posters every year. We also provide the employment law, commonly required employment law posters, on our website at no charge. But like the poster companies, we also develop composite posters and sell those every year. We maintain a website with fact sheets and frequently asked questions. At this point, I believe we have 82 fact sheets that are available at any time of day for employers to take a look at. And these are the most frequent questions that we get, and they are written in a way that businesses can understand those with no legalese. And then every year we host a 2-day employment law conference, generally in November or December. This will be our 33rd annual employment law conference. And the attendance for that employment law conference has increased every single year. Our staffing, we have 7 full-time employees right now in technical assistance. 3 of those positions receive general funds. One of those positions is limited duration. We did receive an additional training and development specialist due to Oregon sick time, and we will lose that position at the end of June. So we will be down to 4 training and development specialists who are responsible for conducting the training, for answering these phone calls, for writing the handbooks and the website information, as well as the manager, who also spends 20% to 25% of my time conducting those seminars and doing those phone calls. And then we have 1 administrative specialist to assist with the orders and finding site locations and catering and all of that for seminars. So 4 of these positions are other funds, and they are paid for with the sales from the posters, the handbooks, as well as the seminars. And on this slide, it shows our funding sources. So 25% of our funding is general fund, and that supports, again, 1 training and development specialist and our administrative specialist. The other positions are totally supported with other funds. And these, again, are the fees that we receive from conducting seminars, our annual conference, selling those posters and publications. Just some facts. This is for the most recent biennium. We answered over 25,000 phone calls and emails. And I believe there was a question about how many a day. In this period of time, there were 250 work days. So it's a little over 100 phone calls and emails per day that the unit responded to. We conducted 131 public seminars, and these are throughout Oregon, as well as 118 customized on-site seminars. And these are seminars that are contracted by employers. We also do work with small business development centers, chambers, the Oregon Employer Council, and other organizations who will contract with us to come out and conduct customized training for them. We have a number of employer handbooks. I talked about our annual conference, and last year we had 425 people from all over Oregon, as well as employers from outside of Oregon who do have businesses here in Oregon and deal with employee issues. This chart just shows the number of telephone and email inquiries we have received since 2012, and you see a huge increase in this last year. And we know that there are a couple of reasons for that. One is Oregon sick time, Oregon minimum wage. And then we also get phone calls from employers who have questions not just about Oregon law, but about federal law. So you may be aware that last year, the U.S. Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division had proposals that were supposed to go into effect December 1st of 2016, which would have raised the minimum salary level for an exempt employee. This was federal law, but it was going to affect Oregon employers, and we saw a huge increase in telephone calls. So my staff had to be very, very familiar with the all the aspects of that law and be able to advise employers. In fact, we went out and did some on-site customized training based upon employer demand for that. These are the seminars that we've conducted over the last couple of years. I believe we went back 8 years to show all the different seminars. When I started in the unit 10 years ago, we did wage and hour laws, we did family leave laws, workplace harassment discrimination, and we were very limited. We did not conduct a lot of different topics. But due to employer demand, due to the new laws that happen every year, both on the federal and state level, there's more demand for a variety of training. One of our more popular seminars that we started conducting about 6 years ago is our new supervisor training series. We were finding that a lot of employers were having some issues because their supervisors were good at their jobs, were promoted into a supervisory position, but did not have that background of what is workplace harassment, when do you have to give breaks and meal periods, how do you discipline an employee appropriately, what's the importance of documentation. So that is a six-part series over a six-month period of time for new supervisors that has proven to be extremely popular. In fact, many employers will call us before our seminar schedule comes out to see if they can pre-register to get their staff in there. It's also one of our more requested topics when you do an on-site training for a business. These are the on-site trainings that we have developed specifically due to an employer's specific need. For example, there was one employer who wanted to know what the claims process was like. I mentioned the proposed overtime changes under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That was developed specifically for an organization who asked for that, and then other organizations found out about it. So we conducted a number of trainings on those topics. And you will see that the number of seminars that have been conducted every year has increased, and there was a pretty large increase last year. Again, we did a lot of trainings throughout the state on Oregon sick time, and that was based upon employer demand. They were very well attended, and I believe off the top of my head we did around 45 seminars around Oregon in January, February, and March on Oregon sick time only. We're all over the state. My trainers and I travel frequently. You will see out of the 249 seminars that we conducted, 25% were in Portland, Salem, and Eugene. And these are parts of the state that get a lot of training. There are a lot of opportunities. But when you go out to Tillamook or to John Day, Baker City area, or to Klamath Falls, there are not a lot of companies traveling to those areas to provide this type of training. So we make an effort to at least twice a year to get out and do around through the state. For example, last year one of my trainers was in Eastern Oregon, and there was a lot of snow in Eastern Oregon last week. But he was in Baker City, Ontario, Pendleton, LeGrand, and the Dalles. And some of those employers followed him from Ontario all the way to the Dalles and went to training every single day last week. So there is a demand and a need for this type of training in all parts of the state. We do have an excellent customer service rating. You will see that we're not meeting our target for the last 2 years. The reason for that is prior to 2014, our excellent customer service rating was based solely upon our seminar evaluations. And we did very good seminar evaluations, as you can see. In 2014, we changed to our rating being based upon a survey. So we have a survey link at the bottom of all of our emails that goes to all of the employers that we deal with in response to every question. And employers are able to rank us on that survey. We still get excellent ratings in many areas. Where we find that our percentages of customer satisfaction have gone down are based upon the fact that sometimes businesses don't like new laws. They don't like the fact that we cannot give them legal advice. We can only advise them about the law and give them best practices and least risk options. But we cannot advise them on the law because we're not attorneys and we're not that employer's attorney. And there's also sometimes complaints about the fact that we didn't do training in their part of the state when they wanted it. But for the most part, we do get excellent comments. Our call response within 2 business days, which is our key performance measure, is excellent when you consider the number of phone calls that we get in technical assistance and the variety of calls we get. We can get a phone call that's very simple, such as, when's the final paycheck due? That's a pretty simple question. We can direct them to our website that has the frequently asked questions that gives them that written information. But those are easy questions. But we also get questions that require quite a bit of research, such as someone who has an injured worker, has a work-related injury, also has a disability. There may be some issues around family leave for that employee. And if you've ever dealt with a family leave issue with Oregon family leave, the federal family leave, and maybe some disability types of questions thrown in, those can be extensive research and a lot of time spent with those employers to give them that information. We also get a lot of phone calls that are not for BOLI. We answer a lot of calls and direct a lot of employers to workers' comp, or the Oregon Employment Department, or the Oregon Department of Revenue. So in addition to the staff needing to know wage and hour laws, civil rights laws, family leave laws, other employment laws and best practices, we also need to know where to direct a caller, because it's our goal that no employer should call technical assistance and not get some type of assistance. These are just some of the comments from our customer satisfaction survey that you can read at your leisure. I do want to point you to my favorite one, which is, the BOLI answer department appears to be the best run government department in the state. Thank you. We do like that one.
Signed, Brad Bachman. Excuse me.
But we do have a lot of feedback from employers who call. It is sometimes kind of funny when you answer the telephone and they go, oh, I thought I was going to get a recording. So in this last year, 98.6% of our phone calls were answered either the same day or within 24 hours. And I think that is exceptional when you consider the size of the staff and the volume of calls that we get every day. Here's some of the challenges, some of the things that we deal with all the time. We're primarily a self-supporting unit. Every time I come and talk to a group such as yourself, and frequently when I talk to an employer group, they say, why do you charge for your handbooks? Well, this is all information that is readily available on the internet. You can look at statute, you can look at administrative rule. That information is all there. Our handbooks are written in a way that we answer the most frequent questions employers have and in a way that they can understand. It's not required that we do so, but it is a way that we support the unit. We would love to have all of these online at no charge, but then we're in the position of laying staff off because we're not able to support the staff in the unit if we don't charge for these types of issues, for these types of programs. We also have dealt with this by adding to our frequently asked questions and fact sheets that are on the website. So if an employer does have a question at midnight on Saturday why they'd be dealing with an employee issue, then I don't know, but it could happen that they still are able to go to the BOLI website and get some of that information. So we're primarily self-supporting, so we do have to charge for the seminars, for the handbooks, for the composite posters. We also have a need to balance our resources between responding to those employer phone calls immediately, which is when an employer needs an answer. If they're dealing with something, they can't wait 2 days to get a response. So we need to ensure that we have staff available to answer those phone calls on a daily basis. But we also need to focus on the activities that generate revenue, which is writing those handbooks and conducting those seminars. New laws at both the state level and the federal level just increase the number of phone calls that we get. So we do constantly struggle as a team to ensure that we are up to date with new things that are going on, and making sure that we're reading cases, that we're aware of what's going on, not only on the state level, but the federal level, so we can respond to those inquiries. We really want to maintain, and not only maintain, but to increase our training in rural Oregon. We do struggle in rural Oregon with getting word out to employers, to ensuring that we're scheduling at a time that's conducive to employers in that area being able to get to the training. and it's difficult to, sometimes to generate sufficient revenue to conduct training for smaller audiences. So some of the things that we're doing to improve and to work on these issues is, we, like I said, we configured our phone system, and I think that has also led to more employers calling us. The word gets out that if you call technical assistance, you're going to be able to get somebody. They're a safe harbor. They know what they're talking about. We're also researching remote training options. We're looking at doing some webinars. We're getting ready to do kind of a demo for some of our good customers in our field offices to make sure that we don't mess it up. But that is not, that's not ideal. I think webinars for discrete topics or for brand new topics would really meet a need for businesses. But if you've ever sat on a webinar, if it goes longer than 60 minutes, you're running to the bathroom or talking to somebody else or doing other work. You're not going to sit there for longer than 60 to 90 minutes on a webinar. But we are looking at that as another option to get more training out there. We're working with partnering with the chambers and other organizations to bring training to their area. For example, last fall, the Lincoln County Small Business Development Center got in touch with me and said, we really need some training for restaurant and retail employers in this area, and contracted with us to go out and provide some training to those employers in those areas. And I think that was successful. I think we were disappointed that we did not get more people to those trainings. We've just worked a couple weeks ago with Mal here to, when we were doing training in Ontario, and I contacted every single person I knew in Ontario, as well as working with the Small Business Development Center, the Treasure Valley Community College, and the chamber there, and we had a full house in Ontario for training. So we're working harder to make sure that we can make those connections. Filling training in Portland, Salem, Eugene is never a problem. We can always fill those rooms. It's those other areas that we work with to get more people there. We're also working at providing half-day seminars as opposed to a full-day seminar, mainly to accommodate those smaller employers who might not be able to be away from their office or the place of business for a full day. We completed an e-commerce project for online registration prior to February something of 2015, every registration was faxed or mailed in. It was entered manually. It was a long process, and employers were frustrated. So we completed an e-commerce project to have online registration, and that has been very successful. We're currently working now on having an online publication store, because we're still doing the old-fashioned way of the business filling out the order form, faxing or mailing it in, and then we process it. It takes a little bit longer. So we actually have, we'll be starting our testing process next week to get that online. And we're also, again, adding resources available on our website. We've recently gone through and updated all of our fact sheets, all of our frequently asked questions, and add more as employers demand. When we have team meetings, we talk about what types of questions are you getting, and so we're trying to add more information that's readily available to businesses.
Ms. Jermanson, we had a conversation 2 years ago about moving your reservation and your retail programs online, so getting that done is a positive step. When I order a couple of handbooks, do you handle the fulfillment of that in-house, or do you contract that out? Who stuffs the manuals in an envelope and sends them out to the people that have ordered them?
Okay, Chair Gomberg, thank you for that question. We do have an email service or a fulfillment service. And so the process now is going to be with these online publication store that we're setting up, is the order will come in, the person will put in their credit card number, we will ensure that the orders come through okay, and we'll immediately send it to our fulfillment service. And so the anticipation is that within a day to 2 days of receiving that order, it's going to be on the way to the person that ordered that.
All right, thank you. Oh, Representative Rudin, I missed that. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Easy question. I look at all these seminars and all the information that a business person needs to know,
and I'm really glad I never went into business for myself. It just must be overwhelming. So anyway, the question is, do you have information about the size of companies that use your service? Is it smaller companies, medium, large, or do we know? I'm just curious.
Okay, Chair Gomberg, Representative. We don't keep statistics. We're a very small program, but I can tell you that it's a pretty much an even split between very small businesses and those larger businesses. What we find is that for smaller businesses, it's generally the owner or maybe an office manager or shop manager that attends these trainings or orders these handbooks. For the larger businesses, it tends to be someone who, the human resource manager in most cases, who is our customer. My belief is that the smaller businesses are really who needs us. But I would say it's a pretty even split between the two.
Just curious. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Any other questions? Well, let me say, as a small business owner who is married to the Human Resources Department, that we have indeed taken advantage of your technical assistance programs, and I would echo the positive reactions that you've received.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is Brad Abaki and Commissioner of Labor and Industries. That concludes our presentation. I just wanted to thank you for your time, for your consideration of the Bureau's budget, and for what I thought were very thoughtful questions and discussion about what it is we do. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. We have a few more thoughtful questions for you, so don't pull away too quickly.
Tell you around.
No.
And I wanted to wait and address this generally, rather, because I think it's Bureau-wide rather than any particular department. And as you might imagine, it's a question regarding delinquent accounts and money owed to the department. One of the things I note in looking at your history is that you began the year with about $4 million in accounts receivable, finishing the year with a little over $1 million in accounts receivable, which appears very positive on its face. But the number that jumped out at me is within that $4 million that this year you recorded about $3,500,000 in reversals. Reversals, and I wonder if anybody could help clarify that to me.
Mr. Chair, give me just a minute to sort through your question. The $3 million in reversals.
I'm Christy Hammond, the Deputy Commissioner. I'm sorry, I'm not sure where your amounts are coming from. We prepared a report showing the current amounts owed to the agency and to wage claimants, but I don't know where you're getting the beginning of the year and the end of the year.
I'd be happy to hear a summary of your report, but let me clarify for you that I'm referring to the legislative fiscal annual report on delinquent and liquidated debt for 2016. And it shows a beginning balance of $4,010,000, an ending balance of $1,179,000, and one of the items on that is a list of reversals for $3,005,000, which I found interesting. I infer from this that reversals mean that some of these debts were reviewed in court and overturned, but I just wanted to clarify.
No, Mr. Chair, we're going to bring up Terry Bonebrake, who handles the fiscal services for the agency. He can give you a specific answer to that question in a much more general sense, because you've touched on several different things. Oftentimes when you look at these numbers, you'll see large amounts of money that are being collected for individuals who are owed wages. And oftentimes we're not able to collect, but that's because sometimes we're issuing orders against businesses that have gone out of business, do not have the ability to pay. And even though with some of those businesses that break the law, we have to dog them for years in order to collect for the individual, oftentimes you just simply cannot collect. And so that's one of the underlying reasons for what you see sometimes as uncollectible debt. But with regard to your specific question, let me hand that over to Mr. Bonebrake.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, Terry Bonebrake. To answer your question,
The numbers that you're referring to are focused specifically on the delinquent accounts. What you're seeing in there is the reversals actually are an indication of the switch between sending our delinquent accounts to public Department of Revenue and private collections firms, as well as what's known as the pass-through. Those are dollars that we are attempting to collect, but they're not necessarily dollars owed to the agency. They're dollars owed to employees. So they're wages that we are trying to collect on behalf of employees as we go forward and look at those delinquent accounts. So it's not necessarily money owed to the agency in most cases. It's really wages that we're trying to collect on behalf of the employees. I know that with the delinquent reports, they are currently changing how those reports are being put together and the compilation of those reports. And there was some confusion about the pass-through and how to reflect that on the reports. I've been in contact with the statewide accounts receivable staff at DAS, and we are working on trying to get that more streamlined based on the new reporting processes. I do know there's some additional bills that are being looked at this session to see how we can improve that process. But a lot of what we encounter is that handoff between sending our outstanding accounts to Department of Revenue, when that transfers to a private collections firm, and how that money is portrayed as far as owed to the state, owed to the agency, or owed to the individual. So that's currently where we're at now. And that's where those numbers are coming from.
All right. I appreciate that that explanation. And yes, LFO is collecting more information, which we think is a good thing. You will note, of course, that this committee has been particularly interested not only in delinquent debt, but also in write-offs and other kinds of transfers. So if I understood your answer correctly, you're saying that that if you make a finding that money is owed to an employee, and that initially shows up on your books and you transfer it off to revenue, it comes off your books. Whose books does it go on to? Did that question make sense?
No, I'm not sure I quite followed the question.
All right, so you started out by saying that that you make a finding against an employer that they owe some money to an employee. And so you send that, at some point, you send that collection issue to the Department of Revenue to pursue, or to a private collection agency. So those receivables are no longer on your books. Whose books are they on?
Representative Comberg, member of the committee, thank you for the question. In some cases, we have extended length of time that we pursue collections outside most agencies. So in some cases, we will pursue collections for 3 years at least. And in some other cases, if there's a judgment, we may pursue those for 10 years. So at that point, they never come off our books until we get through that judgment process, of which the agency can then renew those judgments if they so inclined to do so. And we would continue to pursue those delinquent accounts as long as we possibly can. So in that regards, from an accounting perspective, the agency doesn't get to write those off right at 6 months or 90 days or 3 years. In some cases, those will stay on our books, and they will be out there for 10 plus years, depending on the case itself and whether or not the judgment's been renewed going forward.
All right, and I assure you, I'm not trying to be adversarial here. I'm just trying to be informative and to get a clearer picture here. So when I read the report here from LFO, and it shows a reduction in your receivables by $3.5 million because of reversals, I'm not sure whether you're telling me those amounts are still on your books or whether they got transferred someplace else. As I read the report, they're not on your books because your total has declined from $4 million to $1 million.
Correct. Chair Comberg, that again, it goes back to the reporting inaccuracies that we've had in the past with this annual report that we're putting together and how those amounts have been put on that report. So we never post them out there on our accounts as far as delinquent. They're always in a collection process at some point in time. Whether we're pursuing them, Department of Revenue is pursuing them, private collections firms are pursuing them, at some point they do get sent back to the agency as uncollectible from those Department of Revenue or private collections. However, that doesn't allow us just to write them off. It is a reversal in the fact that they have returned them to us, but we are still pursuing them from a collection perspective as an agency because there's a judgment. There's still a possibility that potentially we will collect on those. So that reversal is really more of a mechanical issue of the accounting and when it's being sent back to the agency from Department of Revenue, private collection firms, and that way.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that explanation. So let's talk about the money that's on the books, whether it be $4 million or $1 million. And I'm presuming that that money comes from a variety of your different departments. Some of it will be wage and hours, some of it will be civil rights. When there is an account that's in the receivable column, does that go to a centralized department or desk within the Bureau, or does each of your departments handle their own individual collections?
Chair Comberg, members of the committee, thank you for the question. Primarily, all of our outstanding balances and delinquent accounts really are primarily associated with our wage and hour division. It is actually for wages owed to employees that we are trying to pursue. It's very rare that we have outstanding delinquent accounts within the civil rights or some of our other divisions. The wage and hour division themselves has a judgment unit. So as these cases go through the process and we actually seek judgment or have outstanding receivables, it's pretty much handled primarily through the judgment unit and between our accounting staff within the agency.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Any further questions for on this topic or anything for the commissioner? I think that's the conclusion of our thoughtful questions for you. So I appreciate that very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Ms. Lisper, you have been very quiet and very patient, but we're going to move you center stage now.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gomberg and members of the committee. I'm Michelle Lisper with the Department of Administration Chief Financial Office. And I'm going to run through very briefly my presentation since most of it is just a recap at a very high level for the governor's budget. Some of the big emerging issues or that we identified during the governor's budget that the agency has already spoken about that they are working with is sick leave for employees, minimum wage laws, and the work that they're doing in communicating, educating employers, working to ensure the compliance activities on an ongoing basis are consistently carried out and fairly. Additionally, things that were talked about in the apprenticeship program and their expansion and communications with apprenticeships, trying to reach out to a larger base, direct, as I mentioned earlier, women and minority, and not just in the construction, but as well as in the manufacturing trades. This chart here is basically showing you their expenditure history, actuals from 2015, and their FTE count, full-time equivalents. We have for 13-15 from 15-17 legislative approved in governor's budget. You will also notice that there were cuts made in the governor's budget. In comparison to legit proof, there were minimal for this particular agency. As based on expenditure categories, this chart is showing you the makeup of their overall budget. From our perspective, about 71% is personal services, which you would expect to see given the fact that they do a lot of work with employers and employees, and it's a human resource-based agency. This gives you a history of revenue. It's also, I believe, it's also part of LFO's paperwork as well. But you can see the actuals. If you look at the blue section in the bottom is general fund. Going back to the 2009-2011 biennium, you'll see steady minimal increase in general fund. You'll see probably bigger, it looks bigger in the red, bigger changes of other other funds, and then unemployment insurance taxes contribution in the revenue has increased over time. Federal funds, pretty stable. Internal measures and investments. So we have the agency is working to improve e-commerce, improving public access to online services, as they mentioned, in all of their divisions, improving and trying to tackle civil rights services and barriers. The divisions rescinded a policy in 2016 that they had mentioned requiring notarization on complaints filed by persons alleging violations of law enforcement by the division. So they are making improvements and doing internal measures with the resources that they have. Other adjustments made are we made adjustments to the DAS state price list and the state government service charges, which was a reduction in the governor's budget as things changed as we got from beginning to end in the governor's budget. We adjusted across the board to agencies that impacted. Specifically, the reductions to this agency in the governor's budget, we did eliminate three positions and reduced one position to part-time status, as well as reducing their service and supplies agency-wide. It was a total of three positions and 2.9 FTE. Two-thirds of those came from the original agency's reduction plan that they submitted with their agency-requested budget. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Lister. Any questions?
I have a general question, please. Not to her directly. So if
no, go, no, you were first.
Yeah. It's back to their other presentation. So if I don't want to interrupt.
Well, why don't we start with Representative Reardon, and then we'll find we'll ask your question and make sure we find somebody to answer it.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Gomberg. So I'm a former teacher, among other other things, and a couple of your goals were, if you could back up just a little bit, they were working to do this or that. It's back now. And so do you have internally something more specific? And because it was always grounded in my head, I had to do SMART goals. So they were, and I had to look up to see what that really meant. But specific, measurable, action-oriented, realistic, time-bound. So we were really had to think through what the issue was and when we could get it done and who was going to do what and all those things. Do you have something more specific that you're working on back in the office? Or?
Representative Gomberg, Representative Reardon, specifically at this level of my presentation, no. We do monitor and work with BOLI on some of their internal measures as they communicate with us and their presentation either in the governor's budget book that we pull from or working with the agency. I don't have anything in specific, though, outside of what we would evaluate as you would their performance measures. But if there's something in particular that you want me to research for you that I can pull together in a white paper. There's a lot of things the agency does. Is there a particular area that you want me to pull for?
Chair Gomberg, I'm just kind of poking at, because I was told that's one thing we get to do here, mm-hmm. is poke at, pull at strings.
Sure, not a problem.
And so I'm just trying to understand how the agency works and how you affect goals, how you affect change, because we're all striving to do more with less and serve our customers better. So, and that just struck me as so vague, really, that I had to ask about it. So I hope that maybe I've caused you to also want to think about it as well. So through that inquiry, I will stop there.
I'm going to go to, Senator Monroe.
I notice on slide 4, about a quarter of your budget is for services and supplies. Question is a portion of that, or major portion, AG charges?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Monroe, I would have to give you, I can't tell you the exact split right now, though I can get you that information. I do have it down to that detail. I would say that for them, the majority of their service and supplies, personal services has a service and supply charge for each individual that there's a percentage of dollars for each individual. I do not believe, but I'd rather get you specific information on what their budgeted AG costs are.
Yeah, I'm always interested in that. Looks like somebody back there wants to answer it.
You might know specifically, Terry. I don't have that.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. Senator Moreau, thank you for the question. Terry Bonebrake. As far as Boley's S&S budget, a significant portion of our service and supplies budget does focus around the Department of Justice line item categories, as well as Department Administrative's for state government service charges, as well as kind of the fixed costs associated with our facilities and leases. The Bureau's service and supplies budget associated with discretionary S&S is very minimal. Most of our service and supplies budget is attached to fixed costs that we don't have any any real control over.
So
follow up.
So your AG expenditures, do you have a contract with the Department of Justice where you pay a regular amount, or do you do it on a per item basis?
Chair Convert, Senator Monroe, thank you for the question. We don't have a contract with the AG. However, as an executive branch agency, we are required to utilize the services of the AG, and they do have set rates for what they do charge agencies based on the work that they do for us.
Yeah,
so depending on how much work or how little or time, then it's a billable hour.
Yeah, some of the agencies that I dealt with it in the other subcommittee, I know have a contract with the AG so that they know exactly what their charges are going to be. They pay on a regular basis, and then they use them as they need them. But you don't do that. Would you say that half or more than half of your services and supplies budget goes to the AG?
Chair Conbrew, Senator Moreau, it would not be that much. To answer the specific question right now, in the governor's recommended budget for 2017-2019, we have roughly about $838,000 budgeted for AG services within that biennial period. So it would not equate to half. No.
Okay, no, that's $800,000 out of $6.7 million is way less than half.
Correct.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Just follow up, if I may, just
please.
A moment. On the case that's received a lot of publicity, I think, on the bakery, and it's still working its way through. Do you know how much has been expended?
Chair Conberg, Senator Hansel, I do not know exactly what that dollar figure is. Like I say, it is still working its way through the system, as well as I won't have any final AG cost based on timing. We don't get our bills until a month or two after it's been the services have been provided. So I do not have specifics at this time.
I do have another question.
Please, Senator Hansel, we'll get back to your original question.
Well, there was a slide, at least on OLIS, that I have that did not get covered, which was a 15% reduction options.
Reduction options, yeah.
I think that might be good. I don't know whose presentation was. I think it's probably the
Boley's
presentation. If we have time, it might be good to go over that. I just...
Which department can
It was Boley's presentation, and it's the last slide.
So it's the last slide. Mm-hmm. So that would have been from
I think
from technical
it's
assistance.
A,
I think it's an agency.
I think it's an agency that maybe the commissioner would.
Agencies.
Commissioner, we'll invite you back up for an encore. As best we can tell, there was one slide left at the after the technical assistance presentation that we may have somehow missed.
Brad Avakian, Deputy Commissioner Christy Hammond will go through that slide. We intentionally did not go through that just because we understood the other items were where the committee was focusing more, but are more than pleased to go through that last slide, and Deputy Commissioner Hammond will do that for you.
So I am Christy Hammond, the Deputy Labor Commissioner, Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. This is a summary of a report that we were required to provide to LFO outside of our actual agency request budget. As you may know, part of the process for putting together the agency requested budget, we were required by DAS to put together a 10% reduction plan. LFO actually asked us to put together a 15% reduction plan that focused on general fund reductions, whereas the exercise we went through in preparing our agency request budget was for both general funds, other funds, and federal funds, I believe. So these are concepts that we put together in priority order to get to a 15% general fund reduction to our budget. I don't know if you want me to go through each one or if you have specific questions. They're kind of self-explanatory. Earlier in the presentation, I believe was it Representative Gomberg that asked about our live entertainment hotline. Last session, we were given a position and funding to staff a telephone, toll-free telephone line to respond to telephone calls from live entertainers regarding their status as an employee or an independent contractor. I don't have the data with me today, but I'd be happy to provide it with you. I think the number of calls we have gotten on that hotline are very low and frankly don't require a full-time staff person just for that purpose. So we have been using that position. Actually, it was a half-time position, and we married that position with another vacant half-time position in the agency to create a full-time support position, and that's how it's being filled at this time. So that's an example of how we evaluated what positions that we would suggest be reduced if we were required to reduce staff, and that was the first position that we identified. I think it was also a position that Administrative Services recommended in a 10% reduction scenario.
Question? Senator.
To get the 15% reduction, does it require all of everything on this list?
Yes, Senator Hansel, it does. Okay.
Further questions from the committee? All right. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you.
I do not have anybody signed up for public testimony. If there's anybody who is interested in testifying, now's the time to step forward. That being the case, I'm going to go ahead and conclude the public hearing on House Bill 5016. Thank you, everybody who's participated today. And Ms. Deister, tomorrow we move to
Housing and Community Services, Mr. Co-Chair. We have housing scheduled for Wednesday and Thursday, as well as Monday. I am given to believe you may be receiving quite a bit of public testimony on that particular budget, so we figured we better add a day. And last I looked, there were 90 slides in their slide deck, so settle in.
Housing. And, encourage them to be efficient with our time.
I will do my darndest.
And we'll try and be very efficient with all the public's time. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, thank you all. We are adjourned.
Probably the same people.
Adjourned.
Probably the same people.